Hello and welcome to another year in review episode of Radio Warnerd. This will be episode 491. I'm the co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. And I'm on the line with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher, in the heel of the boot of Italy. John, how you doing?
Oh, pretty good. We're almost home. It's been a grueling, basically round the world flight from Italy to New Zealand. And in case anybody doesn't know, New Zealand is far away. I think it's in this solar system, but not by much. And then we went on from New Zealand, crossed the very inconvenient Pacific Ocean again, and tried to register my claim to Social Security income in the United States, which was a failure, of course. And now we've moved on to Europe. And about somewhere over Greenland, I think I developed, you know, I've never had a fear of flying at all. Like, if the plane's going to go down, good. Fine.
It's not my fault. It's all over and it's not my fault. Yeah.
But I really got sick of flying
on
the trip to Europe. And I started thinking about, and Radio Warnerd listeners might understand this and have a good answer to it, but why aren't there passenger ships? I'd like to go to Europe on a passenger ship. That'd be nice. But as far as I know, there aren't any.
There's cruise ships, tons of them, but it's a good question. Yeah, I don't know if there are passenger ships.
Yeah, cruise ships, I'm not that old. I don't ever want to be that old.
Well, there's whole levels of them. What's weird is there's a whole line of cruise ships for different classes of Americans, sort of the, you know, of wealthier young families.
Oh.
And less wealthy young families.
Oh.
I gotta say, I don't know where, you know, I took our kids to this indoor winter water park in Pennsylvania a couple of years ago, and it just blew me away how expensive it was. And it was clear this was not aiming towards like the upper middle class. It was a very you know, more like a working class to middle class crowd. And it was packed to the gills. And it was so damn expensive. I don't know. I assume people must be like deep in credit card debt right now, which is is probably part of the reason Biden lost, because interest rates soared and inflation soared. And when you have that double whammy.
Wasn't this midwinter when you went to that?
Yes. Yeah, it was. It's an indoor water park. Yeah.
It just sounds like the best way to get a terrible infection that you possibly could find.
Yeah. We've been to, I took them to another one in Canada, more, I don't know, not as, I mean, also roughly the same class, you know, affordable for us. But, definitely way cheaper and not nearly as crowded. I just don't know how people afford the really expensive one. And if you can't, so they go on these cruises too, and they're very expensive cruises, and they fill up, and so it's not just old people. And we know about cruises for old kind of wealthier people, but they have all different classes of them, and they're all different ways of paying for them. You know,
Right. Credit.
You can stagger it. You can finance them. You can take whatever you are going to leave to your kids and spend it on that instead. Like, there's a whole lot of ways that older people go on these cruises.
Well, I think the real reason that I flinch at the idea of a cruise ship is because we spent months in Trieste, and Trieste is a big destination on the cruise line's schedule. And everybody we ran into in Trieste hates the cruise ships.
Yes.
Really hates them. I mean, it's more of a deep political ideology in there.
I think Barcelona, didn't they just try and do, was it about cruise ships? I think that's been building that resentment about cruise ships for a while. Anyway, you're listening to Radio Cruise Ship Nerd, and we are so we are going to try and cover some other wars and what happened in 2024. We'll try and make this one maybe a little bit faster. We should definitely talk about the Horn of Africa. A lot has been going on there. We can briefly talk about Myanmar. It would deserve another episode. We've done some, we've talked about it in the past, but it should just be said that as of the end of this year, the junta only controls now roughly a quarter of its surface area territory. It still controls most of the urban population areas and basically most of the urban most of the population. But in terms of territory, as I was reading, no government had ever lost since the first coup in 1962 had ever lost control over this much territory. So it's a very big deal, and it's in a pretty dire situation. One of the kind of stories that have come out about this, and this just shows the Myanmar story of the last 10 years has really defied kind of simple liberal humanitarian lines, because of course you had the Nobel Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, yeah, who then was basically implicated in the genocide of the Rohingya, and then she was overthrown.
There's a weird pattern Abiy Ahmed.
And then when the junta overthrew her government, everyone who was charging her with genocide came to her defense as the, you know, as the symbol of democracy again.
Yeah.
And down in the Rakhine state where the Rohingya were expelled from and ethnically cleansed, things have gotten strange there too, because during the, what has been by most organizations described as a genocide of the Rohingya, it was the dominant ethnic group, the Rakhine army, who are Buddhist, the Rohingya, of course, being Muslim. They are now the leading anti-junta militia force, and they've been defeating the junta in Rakhine State. And the Rohingya are actually siding with the junta, or what's left of the Rohingya community. About half of them, I think, are in Bangladesh, and the other half are still in Rakhine State. And they are siding, actually, with the junta, which oversaw the genocide of the Rohingya, against the Rakhine army, because the Rakhine army were the sort of the ground troops for the genocide and the ethnic cleansing. So it's kind of, I mean, it just keeps flipping. It's not a really easy story where one side is always bad or on the bad side and one is good. I mean, what can you say? Like, the victims of genocide are siding with the junta that we all agree is really bad. And part of the reason we say it's bad is because of what they did to the Rohingya, who now side with them, you know. So it's very messy there. And groups like the Rohingya, the smaller ethnic groups, are the ones that are, especially in situations like this, are the ones that are going to suffer as the state falls apart.
And their organizations typically are going to have to make really hard decisions and make an alliance with people that they would sooner kill if they had the option.
Look at the Kurds.
Yeah.
Right, so let's talk about the Horn. I just briefly want to introduce, this is more Sahel, but France has already started pulling out its forces from Chad. I mean, maybe this is cheerful news. So by the end of January of next year, France is going to have been completely kicked out of Chad, which is really remarkable. Yeah. We did an episode this year, episode 443, with Nathaniel Powell on France's wars in Chad. And these were France's biggest, post-colonial, neo-colonial wars, counterinsurgency wars.
Yeah, in some ways, those wars provided the managerial class of the French state the kind of esteem or self-esteem that America's various Machiavellian adventures around the world provide to the D.C. crowd.
So it's
hard to know if ordinary people in France are going to care about this, but probably the people who who run things in Paris are going to be very upset about it.
Exactly. That's the interesting thing. I think when France was losing its empire, you know, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe 70s, it was more like, it also pissed off the kind of grumbling red state base. But from what I understand, and no one really cares except for the kind of the elite Sorbonne educated class there.
No more people to mess with.
Yeah. And I mean, it has France, the collapse of France's neocolonial empire is, it's really stunning. And it's all just happened in the last few years. Again, talk about elite failure. Macron represents that, you know, that same wing of Biden, Blinken, Obama.
Yeah.
And he has failed so massively and so spectacularly that in all likelihood, the National Front is going to just slide into the vacuum.
That's clearly a worldwide trend. And there has been, even though the National Front, AfD in Germany, the Republicans in the U.S. are rather repellent creatures in their own right. If you look at the behavior of the supposedly liberal parties in power, it's not at all difficult to understand why people truly hate them so much.
Yeah,
they get a little power and they suddenly think it's 1958 and we're NATO again and we can play the world like some primitive checkers game.
And fail over and over. I mean, elite failure has definitely been 21st century. Elite failure is a ongoing theme, starting with W, right on through today. And I mean, the far right is, in most places, the only way to express your... I mean, they are... seen as and considered, you know, they are more anti-systemic. I mean, they just are. Their politics suck, but they are anti-system. And that is one of the few ways voting for them.
The only answer to their discontent in the liberal elite is like, well, you're bad people.
Yep.
You know, if you don't like the way we're doing it, you're bad people. And the idea that they might have some real objections doesn't get much play.
No. That was one of the shocking moments in our interview with Kelly Vlaus last month, that the Blinken people, that whole network who run Biden's foreign policy, are absolutely convinced and would laugh at you if you said otherwise, convinced that they've done an absolutely bang up job. And
how about we laugh first?
I know. Like you, and I have a good friend who actually is pretty close to that set. I'll keep things quiet, but close to that set socially, not as much professionally, so knows a lot of these people, who had a big falling out with them, actually. He's like, this is exactly why I stand up at the dinner. I wish I could tell these stories of standing up and calling all these people bullshitters and so on. But that they absolutely do think that they are absolutely successful, that they're succeeding. Moreover, that they are, they're basically doing something charitable. They're sacrificing themselves for us. Really, they actually talk this way to each other. And one of my friends from this world socially, you know him, BS, said that like he just couldn't believe, he just stood up and just started calling, like, you are not doing this out of the kindness of, you're not doing this selflessly, you're not sacrificing, you know, you would have been Bill Gates or Elon Musk, but you sacrificed for us. This is your self-interest and you're failing, you know?
Yeah.
And
how wonderful. Yeah. God, I wish somebody had filmed that.
I know. Well, he's kind of been ostracized from a lot since then. But
You know, a lot of news out of DC and increasingly reminds me of something that a woman I used to know once said, that she had actually had dealings with the Long Island Barry Manilow fan club.
Okay, that's scary, all, man. That's
yeah, like... I know. First of all, I had no idea there was such a thing. But she came really from Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh, you know, and she was sort of clued into this other world.
Is that
in
a
Long
rich? That's a rich part of Pittsburgh, or
yeah, okay. Yeah. And I was just open mouthed because I was kind of a Berkeley Pleasant Hill provincial, and I didn't know much, but. She said, I said, what? There can't be a Barry Manilow fan. What? And she said, yes, they have intrigues. They have love triangles. They have complications and coups. And they don't know they're dorks. And that's what I couldn't get. Yeah. And like I say, that's D.C.,
yeah, D.C. is Long Island, Barry Manilow lovers for ugly people, as they would say. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the horn a bit, John. I don't know where you want to start.
Okay. The big story in the horn, the most interesting story anyway, is what happened with Abiy Ahmed's government and Fano. Fano.
First of all, say who Abiy Ahmed is. He's the.
Oh, yeah. Abiy Ahmed, the leader of Ethiopia, who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago after going up to Eritrea and talking to his ancient enemy and making a deal. And the deal effectively turned out to be to attack Tigray, which was a problem for both Eritrea and Ethiopia. So it wasn't as wonderful and peace-loving as everybody thought. Mm. But then he initiated a war with Tigray, basically in order to replace the Tigrayan elite that had ruled the country because of Tigray's outsized role in fighting the Ethiopian junta in the 1980s and 90s, replacing them with an ethnically more diverse or simply Abiy Ahmed-friendly elite. And he described them in very racist terms. Tigrayans were forced out of the country back into Tigray. They were generally considered to be doomed. Then they marched into the capital, Mekelle, in one of the most amazing transformations that I've ever seen in the military history of this era. Nobody expected that. And after that, the war, they moved south toward Addis Ababa. The war entered a slow stalemate. The UAE got involved. But the main effort that was used by Ethiopia to change the population dynamics of parts of Tigray. You'll notice a lot of the stories we deal with in this end of year episode involve the old method of dealing with a troublesome population, just getting rid of them. Abiy Ahmed's government use something called Fano, which F-A-N-O, which is an Amhara militia to wipe out and displace Tigrayans. And this, as I think we said at the time, is a dangerous strategy, although it's a very attractive one. Auxiliaries are cheap. They don't generally require a lot of expensive weapons. You don't even really have to pay their salary, but the reason for that is not so good. The reason is that they take their pay in rape and pillage, and very literally rape and pillage. And they also tend to generate generalissimi who become very big problems for you as the national commander later on. And what happened is Abiy Ahmed basically decided to turn down the flame on the war with Tigray. And he cut a lot of these leaders of FANO, the Amhar militia, loose. And strangely enough, as any idiot could have predicted, they didn't want to be cut loose. They liked being armed bandits, basically. It's a surprisingly attractive life, let's say, for people, especially, well, not people, for young men who have no job prospects and, you know, no conscience and a lot of no's. And whether it's, you know, freelance cavalry along the border states in the U.S. Civil War or FANO Amhara militia in the borders between Tigray and the Amhara region, it's a lot more fun than farming 3 acres for a bare living. And people get addicted to it. And now there is constant fighting between the Ethiopian army and FANO. And this is what's extraordinary, because the Amhara were the one group that was absolutely loyal to the central government, if only because everybody else was trying to break the lock of the Amhara on the Ethiopian government. And now the Ethiopian government is in a fight, a sort of slow civil war, with the militia of the Amhara, their pet ethnic group. Mm-hmm. They are also at war with several different Oromo militias, which have different ideologies in the south. And there's something like massacre and genocide between Tigrayan and Afar in the northeast, up along the Red Sea coast. And that's a particularly grim war because a lot of these Ethiopian quarrels are more ethnic and linguistic than religious, but the Tigrayans are intensely Christian and the Afar are intensely Muslim. And that has the real possibility of developing into a so-called holy war. Mm-hmm. There have been a lot of atrocities on both sides, as is usual. The Afar, I don't know if people know much about them, but the Afar are generally called a fierce people, like scary people, very scary people. And
Tigrayans are called a fierce, warlike people too,
that's
right?
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like, even if you're in a boxing club or something, there's somebody who'll be known as the tough guy. And the Amhara are sort of like that.
Yeah.
So basically, the unraveling of Ethiopia continues while at the top of the government. And this is also another thread that kind of unites many of the stories in this end of year episode that we're doing. While things unravel at ground level, the plotting within the capital and in the higher echelons of the civil service goes on, if anything, in an even more frenzied way than back when things were stable on the ground, because the Ethiopian government has negotiated with the Somaliland government, if you can call it that.
The breakaway Somaliland region, yeah.
For access to the port, to one or more of the ports in Somaliland, which opens up the Red Sea for them again. Somalia, to the extent that there is a Somalia, says you can't do that. But Somalia doesn't, you know, Somalia is sort of busy with other stuff and doesn't yet have the power to retake Somaliland. So Somaliland is making this independent deal with Abiy, who is at least the figurehead for a very, very busy administration. Meanwhile, the...
And the UAE, right? I mean, yeah. The UAE wants its maritime power.
Yeah, like, say, Britain with many continental armies and wars in the past. But then there's the Egyptian and Sudan question revolving around the dam, the Renaissance Dam, which is filling up and could cause all kinds of problems for countries downriver that depend on the Nile, which is a list starting with Sudan and Egypt. So they have every reason to start messing more intensely than they already are with the government in Addis Ababa. So I don't know. It's hard to imagine Abiy Ahmed lasting very long. There's always been a sort of house of cards aspect about Ethiopia, but now there's a house of cards and the breeze is coming up.
Yeah. And as you said, there's a risk of military clashes with Egypt and Somalia, and Turkey is backing Somalia in this battle too. And that's the kind of thing, that could tip Ethiopia.
Yeah. And that would have a religious angle also. And there's a long history of resistance to Islamic conquerors in Ethiopian military tradition. So it could get very messy.
Mm-hmm.
Not like it was already.
I know. And again, just maybe to briefly go over some other stories, what's happened this year in the Sahel. Some of these military juntas that kicked out France and the U.S., Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, they've also been suffering growing insurgencies, Islamist insurgencies. Local Islamic State and Al-Qaeda-linked insurgencies. The Al-Qaeda-linked group, it's JNIM, J-N-I-M. In fact, we may do an episode on this with our previous guest, Rob Ashlar. I know he's been tracking a lot of this. This group, Jamaat Nasr al-Islam wal Muslimin, if I got that right. But they have been pulling off some absolutely spectacular attacks in Mali and I believe Burkina Faso. And then, of course, ISSP also has been very busy there too. And Russia, I mean, a lot of these countries, when they overthrew their French-aligned kind of neocolonialist regimes, they went and relied on Russia and Wagner to help them with their counterinsurgencies. And we did a great episode this year with James Pogue. That was episode 463. James wrote about his many travels in the Sahel and that region. And you know, he made a point that, which I think is true, is that Russia's position in these areas, it's pretty fragile. It's a lot more fragile than it looks. It's not very deep, and their resources are limited, and they're going to be even more limited now that Russia has lost Syria. I mean, they still formally have the port and the base there, but I can't imagine that's going to last too much longer under HTS, Turkish rule. It's probably being bargained for right now, but like, I really doubt the U.S. is going to lift sanctions if Russia gets to keep its bases there. It's just basically how to put it simply.
Right, so, and he has every reason, Al-Jolani, to play nice with his backers right now. You can start tinkering with that later. But at the moment, you say, yeah, I'm your guy.
Yeah. So that could impact Russia's ability to project in these areas. And I don't know how much of a great job they've done anyway, protecting these juntas. I don't know who else these juntas can turn to You know, they're very wary of the West, probably less wary of the U.S., at least in some cases, than of France. France is just deeply hated and did not ultimately do a very good job anyway. So maybe the U.S. might have some opportunities, imperial opportunities there. Yay.
It was an extraordinary thing to see Sahel crowds with the Russian flag. Although, as I recall, it was the Soviet flag more than the Russian flag.
I think it was both. I think it was both. And they do that to piss off France. And it drives the French people. It drives not just France, but the elites aligned with France. Again, we just see this over and over. The elite failure over and over. And there's a class that tends to be wealthier, well-connected, better educated, and way far more powerful than their numbers. And they're aligned with the West in some way. France, you know, the metropole or institutions in the West. And they've been failing and they're hated. And so ultimately they're overthrown. Now, whether these kind of, revolutionary, semi-revolutionary, nationalist juntas and regimes that took over, whether they can succeed. I mean, put it this way, I seriously doubt France, with all of its assets there, is going to be rooting for them to succeed. And there are ways you can make it a little harder for them to succeed. And I'll bet you they're doing it with all those militia groups and Al-Qaeda's and ISIS groups running around there. There are ways you can keep them on their toes.
Yeah, I mean, if you withdraw the French armed forces and French aerial surveillance and all that, the remaining power within the area is not much. And that means you can hire some group to destabilize it cheap.
Yeah. I think we should maybe finish off by talking about Russia and the Ukraine war, unless you had anything else to
add. No, I think we darn well should talk about Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. What would you say is the key fact or the key trend about Russia-Ukraine over the last year?
So I went back and listened to what we said at the end of last year, and it turned out to be pretty true. I mean, that Ukraine had exhausted itself, that it got broken by Bakhmut, and then fully broken by the failed counteroffensive, which was a catastrophic, stupid strategy from the beginning. And Russia is just, it's fighting basically a slow, slow war of attrition. And, and we expected Ukraine to just increasingly get hollowed out, to get more unstable, and for things to get worse for Ukraine. And that happened. Yeah. I guess one surprise is that the huge surprise. So Russia's offensive that it is still in the middle of started after the Ukrainian counteroffensive of 2023 culminated. That started in June and culminated in roughly, let's say, September of 2023 as a catastrophic, costly as hell failure against very well-constructed Russian defenses, minefields, like very active defenses. And then Russia's offensive then started in October, and it rolled out slowly, of 2023. And the story of this year is that the Russian offensive not only has not culminated, because we're used to each side switching back and forth, doing like 2 or 3 month offensives and then being exhausted.
Yeah.
And that happened with Russia in 2022. And it could be argued that that happened with Russia when it tried another offensive sort of December, January, February of 2023. It's maybe debatable how much. I mean, they did go for more than Bakhmut then. They had a disastrous attempt to take Vuhledar. But what they did in Bakhmut was a trap. And it was a very successful trap. In any event, what's gone on now is something that wasn't supposed to happen, which is Russia is now in month 14 of its offensive. Month 14. And not only is it nowhere near culminating, it has been accelerating to a shocking degree. November, the month of November, last month, Russia took more territory in its offensives than any month since the beginning of the war. Since, you know, in the beginning of the war, of course, they were able to take these large swaths of territory, but they couldn't really hold them. Yeah. So that was when it was a very mobile war in the first couple months. And then since then, Russia has fought for every kind of 10 meters of ground. In November, as I said, they took the most amount of, you know, square kilometerage than any month since early mid 2022. And that should freak people out, you would think, in this sort of pro-Ukraine. I mean, it does. Ukrainians see this. It's one of the great things about Radio Warner guest Peter Karataev's great Substack events in Ukraine is what he mostly does is report and quote from what Ukrainians themselves are saying to each other about what's going on. And it is night and day from what we get in our, you know, in our media, from our think tanks, which paints a very different picture than from what Ukrainians are telling each other. Ukrainian, you know, nationalists. I know Peter likes to quote a lot of Telegram channels that are very popular among military bloggers and nationalists and neo-fascist types. They're a lot more, weirdly enough, a lot more honest in a way about what's going on. They're talking about how this, you know, all of the corruption, all the problems that are gotten only worse, all the problems that were only supposed to be endemic to Russia because Russia's authoritarian and it's Eurasiatic and not European and not democratic. And so it's supposed to have the corruption problems. It's supposed to have the abuse problems. It's supposed to have the poor communications problems because that's how the moral universe should work. But Russia actually has proven to be very adaptive and flexible. And that really wasn't supposed to happen in stupid people's brains' ideas of how authoritarian regimes might work, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's really the big sort of overall story. I mean, where is Russia right now? Again, it's not like it's taken huge chunks of territory, but it has been extremely costly to Ukraine, what it has taken.
Right.
Especially in sort of the mid and southern parts of the Donetsk area, the Donbas. One of the main battles that started at the beginning of the offensive in October 2023 was the battle for Avdiivka, which is like a industrial, basically a suburb or exurb of Donetsk, the capital of the Donetsk Oblast, sort of northwest of Donetsk. Mm-hmm. And it was another one of these kind of Bakhmut-like, very grueling battles. And Ukraine was already kind of broken by then. So when Russia won that battle after, I don't know, about 4 months, there was a kind of collapse of lines. Just before the battle was won, Zelensky replaced his kind of rival and the commander-in-chief, Zaluzhny, Valery Zaluzhny, who's now an ambassador, and he basically put him out to pasture in London and replaced him with a loyalist, which again is not supposed to happen in democracies. It only happens in authoritarian regimes. With a loyalist who's known to be a terrible commander and who's hated by his own troops for being, like, there's a whole list of Russian commanders that are supposedly called the butcher of Syria, or the butcher of this, because of the Russian forces under this guy's command, killing people that, you know, where they were conquering. But this guy, Sirsky, is called the butcher because of killing his own troops through...
Generally a lot less popular among troops.
No kidding. The only fan I've ever seen of Sirsky who's remained, because he's very loyal to Zelensky, as Commander-in-Chief. The only fan I've seen is the Economist. Whoever's posting these for the Economist, Ollie Carroll, or Shawshank something or other. I can't remember, Joshi or something like that. He's terrible, though. And even in Avdiivka, he didn't prepare a proper retreat. And this was a big scandal among Ukrainians. And they proved to be bad at this, especially since Zaluzhny left at strategic withdrawals or proper retreats. Sierski's big thing is...
As you've mentioned many times, the bigger game for the Ukrainian elite is NATO money. Retreat doesn't look good. In fact, they get frowned at when they retreat.
Yeah, they start to look like losers. And that's, it's kind of that crude for the American elite. And this goes back many, many decades. Reading about even sort of Dulles brothers in the Eisenhower period and about their views on Israel and the various Arab states as policy was starting to form. To them, certainly by the 67 war, Israel were winners. They're bastards and they blew up our ship and all this stuff. But you know what? They're winners. And that is American elite culture. Like they go with winners. And Ukraine, and they know, there have been articles that have been pretty open about this. Ukraine has been basically doing a pageant show or doing an interview, a job interview to join, and they got to prove themselves. Are you winners or losers? And it's an impossible task, actually, that they were put up to.
And what's really terrible about this is that there have been a lot of meat grinder wars for centuries, but rarely in a place that's so demographically precarious.
Yeah.
I mean, Ukraine, in some of the stories that you see about the demographics of conscription, they describe it almost in terms of a story on an endangered species.
Yeah.
Like, there aren't going to be enough Ukrainians in the fertile age range.
Yeah, and speaking of that, the U.S. has been pushing hard, as we had predicted, publicly. Blinken, Biden, Lindsey Graham, Congress, I'm sure Bill Burns, the CIA chief who was just out there, pushing Zelensky hard to lower the draft age to 18. And what 18 to 25-year-olds are starting in January going to be called up for military training. It's not the same as being mobilized for war, but it might be seen as a halfway move. I asked Peter about that, and he said basically this means that corrupt commanders get to enslave a bunch of free workers to build their dachas and pick their potatoes, like in the way the Russians did that in the Yeltsin years. But he also agreed that there's a good chance. Because to Zelensky and to the NGO crowd, as you said, pleasing America, pleasing the West means pleasing America.
Right.
Pleasing them means everything. And right now there's a blame game. And the pro-Ukraine crowd, the Zelensky and so on, they're all trying to blame, it's just still blows me away. They're all trying to blame their failures on Biden's personally, the Biden administration, Jake Sullivan. They don't seem to hate Blinken as much, but they very specifically blame Biden and Jake Sullivan for intentionally making sure that that Ukraine lost. And America has never gone to bat, never given so much, even to Israel. I mean, they've never given in monetary and material terms so much weaponry, so much aid to a non-NATO member, moreover.
Yeah.
And the deal was, we're not going to get, this war, we're going to do this up until we actually risk getting involved directly. We're not going to get involved directly. Biden said that, and he's kept testing the line, but so far we haven't been directly, there isn't a direct full-on World War III. And that was the deal.
No, which is really remarkable, by the way, because if positions were reversed and Russia stepped over all the lines that we had drawn in the sand, I think there'd be hell to pay.
Yeah. So the Biden people and the people who are kind of more in the know really say, this is your fault, Ukraine, because you wouldn't draft, which is true. They didn't. It's kind of strange, but it says something about the state and the people's, the public's relationship to the state. We did a great episode with Volodymyr Shinko about how hollowed out the state is and the alienation between, you know, the masses and the state versus the aristocracy and the NGO class. But, you know, Zelensky didn't order a full mobilization until April of this year, and that was the pro quo for Biden putting everything on the line to get $60 billion in aid, a new package in aid, for which he was never, you know, for which he only got blamed then afterwards by the pro-Ukraine crowd. I mean, he got really nothing from them. It's kind of bizarre. They look at him as Chamberlain.
That was one of the hallmarks of his late administration. It was like, you do everything for Ukraine. You do everything for Israel. And they both abuse you constantly.
They abuse you and they despise you for it. It's really remarkable. So getting back a little bit, I guess, you know, bigger picture, where are we? The collapse of Vuhledar, which I talked about, you know, Russians tried taking it in early 2023 and lost a lot of very high quality troops, units, equipment, trying to take this fortress city, very well dug in fortress, one of the better defended cities, because Ukraine has been terrible at defense in a lot of other areas. The old fortress cities, the ones that were built up from 15 through 22, like New York and Tarietsk, which is still kind of partly holding out, those were the hard ones to take. Well, the Russians took Vuhledar this year, and it's because Ukraine's military and state is hollowing out so badly. And when Vuhledar collapsed, they were able to move more quickly since then, and that's why the pace in October and then November were sort of like record paces for the Russian military. Also, when they took Avdiivka after that, then they moved closer and closer towards Pokrovsk. Near Pokrovsk is a large coking mine. In fact, and it's right outside of Pokrovsk, on top of Pokrovsk being a really important logistics hub, which we've talked about.
Right.
Just on the sort of the south, kind of, what would it be, western kind of outskirts of Pokrovsk is this massive coking coal mine, which is used for their entire metallurgical, whatever's left of the metallurgical industry, because a lot of that was in the Russian-held part of the Donetsk. I think 90% of the coking coal, which is needed to, you know, smelt the iron, smelt the steel, it comes from this one mine, and the Russians are literally right outside of it right now.
Yeah, the maps I've seen show them sort of like tickling the edges of Pokrovsk.
Yeah. They kind of went up to the edge of it, especially after another disaster at Achiryetine, which is further back when the Russians took Achiryetine, and it was taken very easily. They took it during a rotation because, again, Ukrainian units and brigades, there's terrible communications. There's no like uniformity. It's just, it is such chaotic disaster in the Ukrainian military right now. And the Russians have taken advantage of these sort of rotations when they happen, which isn't nearly often enough, and just move right in and take advantage of the chaos. The Russians also moved kind of south of there and took another key hub, Kurakhove, which people thought it was going to take a lot longer for them to take Kurakhove, which is a city that's kind of adjacent to, like north of it is a really large reservoir, and it was very well defended, but it's fallen a lot easier than people had expected. Up in the north, they've crossed the Oskil River, both south and north of Kupiansk, so they've established beachheads on both sides. It's another key city up in the Kharkiv region. It's just a terrible pace for the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians tried to kind of recreate the magic of the fall of 2022 when they did that big blitz that took back a whole bunch of territory because it was so light, as we found out, it was really just very lightly defended territory in Kharkiv, but they took a massive amount of territory then, the Ukrainians did.
My impression, and maybe I'm wrong here, is like Russia is a much bigger country, much bigger economy.
Yes.
They can wear Ukraine down, like, you know, yes, a big boxer just sort of leaning into this a smaller boxer and occasionally hitting him. It doesn't have to be a beautiful win. It will just eventually wear the smaller fighter down.
Yeah.
And my impression is that the war in Ukraine, mm-hmm, in Russian society, gets more of a shrug, whereas it's an issue of life and death in Ukraine.
Yeah, Putin has constructed this war economy, Keynesian military Keynesianism, as Ishenko called it, which is very different from what Ukraine has done. Whatever options Ukraine may have had, but Russia has basically, working class people in Russia, working and middle class people, have gotten richer. Mm. Inflation has gone up, but especially the closer they are to the military industrial complex or the whole military, the more wealthier they've grown. And so there's a lot of material interest in supporting the war. The shrugs come more from the places like Moscow, the big cities, where they're not recruiting as much. Yeah. And they're leaving them, more or less alone. They recruit from there mostly to get all the people who are always moving in from the regions into a place like Moscow. Those are the people they would recruit, not the actual longtime residents of, Moscow, St. Petersburg. And the recruitment, like, there was a thought that Russian recruitment was getting tougher 6 months ago. But now the thought is, no, that really isn't happening. They're more than replacing, whereas Ukrainians aren't. The Ukrainian military is very, very hollowed out.
Part of the friendliness and the it's an ironic angle on this, but you tell me if this is correct. Like, the embrace of the European community toward the population of Ukraine would mean that for young Ukrainians, the job possibilities are in Europe or even in Canada or somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's actually going to contribute to the hollowing out of
Absolutely.
Ukraine.
Absolutely. And, they have millions of refugees, including young people who've been able, if you could get out. Women, a lot of women, of course, and children left. They were able to leave. Men have not been able to legally leave, though there have been all kinds of ways to buy your way out or just straight up cross a river illegally into Romania. Some of them died or been shot, but they've escaped. And there have been polls done of these millions of refugees from a country already suffering a demographic crisis, and roughly half of them do not plan to ever return.
Right. Yeah,
which makes sense also.
When we were passing through Canada recently, there were large Ukrainian contingents in many of the hotels that we stayed in.
Oh, wow.
It was surprising.
The refugees were put up in hotels?
Yeah.
Wow. So they're still there. So I guess Canada is still hoping to send them back.
It's a lot harder to send people back than it is to just not let them in. That's been demonstrated many times.
Yeah. So we've had Peter on, we've talked about Ukraine's military problems, and Peter just put out a Substack, his great Substack. Quoting from this kind of deep dive article in Strana, a great media outlet, is what I've been following since I don't know, since for like 15 years now, or Ukrainian sort of, it's always been an opposition, whoever's been in power. But since, is it since Zelensky's time, I think they've actually been censored and banned even before the war, and its editor had to flee the country. And they're accused of being Russian agents, you know, the usual bullshit, but they're very mm-hmm. good. And I know a lot of, they're just a lot more truthful than, and telling, they're patriotic. I mean, they're pro-Ukraine, but they just don't pull their punches and never have. And so they've been actually even before Zelensky and Poroshenko's time, their editors' apartments would be raided. The kind of stuff you would associate with what, you know, the Kremlin does to opposition journalists in its country. No one stood up for them, though, and still doesn't. But they're really good, and I think they're gaining a lot more credibility because they've been a lot more accurate than a lot of the other kind of government-aligned media in the war. And it's such an amazing, it's long. I want to read as much of it as I can, and stop me if I'm going too far, because this stuff, this article on the problems in the Ukrainian military, it's actually been cited by a lot of people who, a lot of military people in Ukraine. And I think it gives, as I've seen, the most direct, comprehensible analysis for why Ukraine's fortunes are getting worse and worse. And so I'm going to just read some excerpts here. Now, this is, they talked to anonymous officials from the Stavka, from the general command, right?
Right.
And here's a quote. I wouldn't overstate the significance, because what the Ukrainians keep saying, this keeps coming up too, is the Russians have this massive numerical superiority because, of course, their population is much larger. And I've always had questions about that. And here's what they say from the inside anyway. This is a commander. I wouldn't overstate the significance of Russia's numerical superiority. The decline in the number of Ukrainian troops and the increase in Russian forces is a slow process. It's not happening at a dramatic rate. A far bigger problem is the quality of Ukrainian soldiers being lost and those being sent to the front as replacements. The front lines are still held by highly motivated fighters who joined early in the war, but these are the ones who are killed first, lose combat effectiveness due to injuries, or simply burn out from exhaustion. Meanwhile, they are being replaced by forcibly mobilized personnel with significantly lower motivation. And again, I'm sure people have seen this by now. It finally made the major Western press, not in a big way, but in a smaller way, the endless stream of videos that Ukrainians post of forced mobilization vans.
For me, it was the dragooning of the Hare Krishnas.
Yes.
Onto buses to the front. Yeah. I really want to know what happened to the Hare Krishnas in the Ukrainian army.
That was like, I know, that was sort of like a bit of relief because so much of it is actually just so grim. It's mothers or wives crying as they're, and it's not youngs, you know, it's like some 45-year-old, 55-year-old guy who looks a lot older because they're it's peasants and working class people who are largely impressed into the army. It's not the middle class urban people, hardly, at least not until very, very recently. And they're the people with no power. And it's just endless videos of helpless women screaming, surrounding the van, hitting the draft enforcers. And the draft enforcers are doing that to stay the hell away from the front. It's like, you know, Judenrat trying not to be killed. I mean, it's a terrible analogy, but it's kind of like that. So he said, you know, and so the forcibly mobilized, and actually there was just an article in The Guardian about this too, how they're even older now, the average age is getting older and they're sicker. Like there used to be a ban on mobilizing people who are officially partly infirm or, you know, too ill or something, right? So there, you could be partly infirm or fully infirm by some standard that they have. And Zelensky's big mobilization law in April of this year, well, in time, basically ended partly infirm. So they started drafting people who are blind, people with heart all kinds of heart disease, you know, all kinds of various problems. And now they're doing away with even if you're fully infirm, because there's so much corruption in getting those infirm exemptions. You know, everybody's a Donald Trump or a Dick Cheney if you can come up with a few thousand dollars for a underpaid doctor. But a lot of these people genuinely shouldn't be there, you know.
I would think you'd start with blind people, for example.
I know. People who get beaten to death. I mean, there was that one story of this 50-something-year-old man. His wife was begging them not to impress him that he was sick. He had heart problems, and she banged on the doors of those nasty little vans that they have. And the next time she saw him, he was dead, and she buried him. He died in the Wow. draft office. And there's a lot of those stories, too. On corruption. Corruption in the armed forces of Ukraine is no longer just corruption. It's a catastrophe. This is, again, a quote from somebody in the general staff. If you have money and don't want to go to the front, you won't. For a fee, you can arrange to stay in a rear position at any level. And this, I think, is so interesting because you see stories about commanders complaining that their new recruits are sent to the front lines, and then they flee at the first sign of, you know, the first big rocket or artillery attack or the first wave of Russians. And it's like, well, yeah, they shouldn't have been there. And then you think, yeah. Well, in a corrupt place like Ukraine, why are those guys there, you know? Why are they there straight from a far too fast training right into the frontline trench? So he says, for a fee, you can arrange to stay in a rear position at any level. This costs up to $5,000, sometimes less, depending on negotiations. This isn't systemic corruption with a vertical hierarchy for collecting bribes. Remember, Ukraine has a very horizontal structure, which is supposed to be what makes it democratic, but it's bribery and its corruption is very vertical and it's very horizontal too. It's grassroots corruption handled by individual commanders, and it's widespread, said a Ministry of Defense source. Another officer described the process of hidden evasion of combat duty and how it's become entrenched and organized. The further from the front line, the less personnel shortages are felt. In other words, all the personnel shortages are felt in the front lines, which keep cracking. But as you go further back, these units are very well, they're not understaffed. So all rear units, including the territorial, the security companies, the territorials themselves, bridge and infrastructure guards, financial and logistics units, the commander's headquarters to brigade staffs, military educational institutions are fully staffed with no vacancies. To get into a rear
tremendous enthusiasm, yes. I'm sure. And it's been shown to increase at a steady rate with distance from the front.
Yep. To get into a rear unit, you need to be either a relative or acquaintance of a commander, pay $2,000 to $3,000, or give up half your salary every month. That's wild, wow. Man. So that means you don't have any, because it's hard, you know, this is a very poor country, coming up with $2,000, $3,000, $5,000. I don't know what you got to do to get it. That may explain a lot of crime that's going on. But if you just offer a tithe, a monthly tithe, half your salary, that will...
Or, in secular terms, a kickback.
Yep.
Big, giant kickback. So does this bode well? I know we're going to have to wrap it up, but what does this mean? Like, for example, this seems to show that, like in tennis, advantage Russia, but this war used to mean so much to everybody who mattered, not just in the U.S., but in Northern Europe. I mean, it's been stunning to see all this militancy in Northern Europe because, I mean, I grew up with the idea that they were allergic to war, but I guess that was only if they were going to fight it. So if Ukraine loses, if the front collapses, well, first of all, is that likely to happen? And if it does, what would the West, as we say, do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point of all this was to show, first of all, that lowering the age in this now entrenched corruption structure, and it is very deeply entrenched, and Zelensky values loyalty above all, so he's not going to put in anybody that could threaten him who might be able to clean this up. And it's at this stage in the game, it's going to be hard to. What it means is drafting 18 to 25-year-olds, it's just going to mean a lot of poor 18 to 25-year-olds are going to be killed, maimed, or drained of money in their families. Like, that's it. Right. It's not going to change the war. In terms of whether Ukraine is, you know, the big collapse, I mean, everybody thinks it might happen. Put it this way, you can talk now about peace and the need for peace or the need for an armistice or a ceasefire or something. Everybody knows it. All of the, you know, the Azov and, right sector and all their adjacent formations in the military, they're all talking about the need for this now, that there's no choice. They have to come up with some kind of armistice, ceasefire. They have to stop the war at least for several years, because all that's happening is they're being chewed apart and no one sees how this can possibly really stop and be stopped. I think I was wondering, so this story about the North Korean soldiers, right? We've talked about it. We've laughed about it a lot. The Americans, the West, and the Ukrainians first, but then eventually the NATO crowd said, yeah, that Russians are introducing tens of thousands of NATO soldiers. We've yet to see them. But what I think is interesting, a friend of mine in Russia went near the front and talked to some military bloggers, swears that some North Koreans actually have seen combat, that the Russians talk about it now in Russian media and in Russian Telegram, but even they won't show them. So it's so strange. So, I mean, I'm sure there are North Koreans there and it all may be true. I don't know, but neither side has shown them yet. The Russians say that North Koreans have already successfully taken Ukrainian positions in Kursk. The Americans say thousands have already been killed and wounded, and there's not a single legitimate piece of proof. I think why do the Russians want us to think that? To show that they have depth in the one thing that matters most right now in the war, which is manpower.
Yeah.
Russia has the manpower, and they're saying, we have this backup manpower. And
In fact, it's a very awkward development for Ukraine, which gets a lot of lip service and, frankly, a lot of money, but hasn't gotten a lot of troops out of its devoted friends.
But in terms of the war, like, this was the war where, you know, the graveyard of predictions. I don't want to predict if or when there'd be a collapse. People fight even when morale is very low, and it's all you read about in Ukrainian military telegram. And the few honest articles, even in the West, is how low and falling morale is in most units in Ukraine. But there's a large distance between that and actual collapse, and I don't know what that takes. Even if you have the greatest right-wing neo-Nazi patriot of all Ukraine telling Zelensky, you have to do the ceasefire. If Zelensky does a ceasefire, it's going to be bad for him. I don't care what nobody ever got popular signing a defeat armistice in their country. It just doesn't happen like that. So it's going to be, I don't know how you end the war. I mean, I think at least people are coming around to the idea that it has to end. Now, one thing I find just kind of amazing is the explicit American goal, strategic goal in this war, was to massively degrade Russia's military capabilities to the point where they couldn't project beyond their borders. And it's kind of 50-50 in a sense here, because Russia has lost Syria and Russia is losing Armenia, one of the very few countries where it has a base, you know, foreign country where there are Russian military bases. I don't think Russia cares a whole lot about losing Armenia because they value Azerbaijan much more. But losing Syria is, you know, that's for Washington's, that crowd, that's a big win for them, huge win.
Yeah, but, you know, I'll just take a chance here and say, I think Syria is still in play.
Yeah.
the dice are still rolling in Syria. I don't think it's over yet.
I agree.
But
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, what you've described is a clear trend for Ukraine. And yeah, there are a lot of ways it could come out with a regime change
mm-hmm.
to save face and then a peace deal.
There's supposed to be elections. He canceled elections under martial law. And Zelensky has said they're going to hold elections in 2025. And that could be very interesting. How do you hold elections when you've been losing? He's not popular anymore at all. There was a poll that showed just but 16% support versus Zelensky.
It's worse than Biden.
Yeah. So, majority support now for some kind of armistice. Now, people could say they want an end to the war. I remember most of Russians wanted an end to the Chechnya war, the first Chechnya war in 96. They hated it. It was a disaster. They were losing. And Yeltsin got his rival, who he brought on board, Alexander Lebed, the general, to cut a peace deal with Chechnya. And then they blamed the peace deal on Lebed and destroyed his political career.
Yeah.
And it was very unpopular. Like, they wanted the war to end, but it turned out to be a very unpopular move. I don't know. The other side of this, I would say, is that Russia's military is coming out of this war a lot stronger than it went into it. And that's a problem. And that's being acknowledged even by, there was a big article that Michael Kaufman and some other DC think tanker put out in Foreign Policy magazine. And man, the decline of Michael Kaufman has been something, it's its own story. But they were making the point that, look, the strategic goal was to weaken Russia, but their military is far more capable now than it was in 2022.
It's strange they didn't know that because it usually happens when a military fights for a while. They learn things.
And the thing is that they had a chance to end this war early. I mean, they, first of all, could have avoided the war. Then there was a big peace deal that has now been already validated, verified by, sources on every side of the spectrum, that there were peace talks between Ukraine and Russia in March, April of 2022 that had moved very far along towards peace. And the Biden people said, we can hurt Russia more and get a better deal and killed it. And they could have maybe tried to do a peace deal at the peak of their success in the fall of 2022, but they thought, these guys are easy, we can wipe them, we can crush them even more. And now you actually have a Russia that's a far more effective military, specifically against NATO American weaponry and tactics. It's unbelievable, right? And I would add to that, Russia has lost potentially lost Syria as an ally, but Russia has gained an ally in China and in many ways, India, and that matters a lot. This war has pushed Russia and China very close together, and the way that the DC establishment has tried to cope with that is, ha-ha, Putin, Russia's now a vassal state of Z. He'll tell you everything to do. That is the saddest cope line I've seen. They all tried to tell each other that. No, they actually have a far more formidable ally. It's because of their far closer ties with China and India that Russia's economy has actually been able to weather nuclear sanctions and is going strong. That's a big problem. So you have a far more formidable military and a far more formidable alliance. And what Michael Kaufman and his co-author said was, we need to really do something against Russia. Otherwise, they're going to be emboldened by defeating Ukraine and move on to something else. And it's like, you idiots, that's why you said we needed to do everything we did in Ukraine. Otherwise, they'd be emboldened. Yeah. Now you're saying, oh, because they've won Ukraine, we need to really, really stop them and put all these weapons and all this crap here in order to stop them from doing something else. Like, it's just failure after failure.
For that matter, I don't remember North Korean troops volunteering for wars very far from their own borders.
Never.
That's an interesting development, and it doesn't bode well for NATO.
No, it's it is. I think, like, I don't know, the Biden-Blinken people don't have anybody telling them bad news. Clearly, they live in a bubble. But I think people who are honest understand this is one of the... If you love the empire, you're American nationalist or whatever, like this is by far the biggest failure imaginable, actually, driving them closer together like that and strengthening the Russian military. So,
all right. Well, you know, on that happy note.
Yeah, I think we can end the year. And thanks again, everybody, for a great year. And thanks to all of our great guests this year, too. And looking forward to another miserable year in 2025. Hopefully it won't be. We knew this was going to be a bad year. Couldn't end quickly enough. It's ended. Maybe we'll have some better news in 2025.
Yeah. So, all right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.